This is HPR episode 2313 entitled, NIL-FS2, and is part of the series, File Systems. It is hosted by Klaatu, and is about 35 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, Klaatu talks about NIL-FS2.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
You're listening to Hacker Public Radio. My name is Klaatu. Today I'm going to talk about file systems, or rather, a file system, with a little bit of background for context. I think I've done this little sort of demo or explanation, whatever you want to call it, on my show, GNU World Order, which you can find at gnuworldorder.info. And it was a while ago if I did. I might even be misremembering. I may not have done this on that show. But either way, I'm going to do it again just to get us all on the same page about what a file system is exactly. Because file system, like the concept, for me used to be pretty mysterious. The programming involved in creating a file system still is, but at least I feel like I get file systems a lot better than I used to, and I want to maybe possibly explain it in a way that you may not have heard before. So rather than explaining it with just words, I'm going to explain it with a little demo. So you can do this along with me at home, if you like. Just be warned that you need some kind of drive that you're willing to completely erase. So I've got a little 2 gig thumb drive here that I got at a conference. And if I plug it into my computer right now and then type in LSBLK, so that's list block devices, LSBLK, all one string. If you don't use LSBLK, then you should start using it. It's a really nice command, actually. I kind of just found out about it myself this past year. And, you know, previously I used to do the whole dmessage, tail, and sort of look at what I most recently plugged in, that kind of thing. And that works, but you do kind of find it maybe possibly difficult to pass on to other people. You know, you're kind of like having to describe it to them. And it's kind of messy output, and yeah, it takes some parsing, visually speaking. So LSBLK is a really nice little layout of all the block devices plugged into your computer, and it's a very attractive, like if you've ever seen the tree command, the directory listing tree layout on Linux, then this is pretty similar to that in terms of layout. It shows you each device, and of course it gives you the name of the device, like, or the designation of the device, SDA, SDA1, SDA2, SDB, SDB1, SDC, and so on. But it shows it to you in a very intuitive way. It tells you SDB, okay, and underneath that is SDB1, so you get that, right? That's a partition within SDB. That makes sense. And then it even tells you the size of the disk, the size of the partition, and it tells you the mount point. So if I've just plugged in this little SDC drive, there is no mount point because I haven't mounted it yet. Well, that's fine. If I mount it, then it tells me where it is mounted to. If I then do the LSBLK again, there it goes, /run/media/klaatu/2GB drive. Easy. And it tells you, like I said, it tells you the size and everything. So it's really easy to sort of identify a specific drive, which if you've ever talked to someone who has accidentally erased a drive or installed their Linux distribution over, you know, their Windows drive because they got confused or whatever, people do it all the time. And this, I just find it's so easy to read that it's very, very reassuring and comforting and hard to screw up, to be honest. That said, you should run the lsblk command to make sure that the thumb drive that you may or may not be following along with is the one that you think it is. So I've just plugged the thing in. I saw that it's a 1.8 gigabyte drive with no partitions on it. That's SDC. And I feel pretty confident that that's the one that I want to destroy. So I'm going to unmount it. And now it's kind of cool because what you can do in Linux, well, first of all, what we're going to do is destroy any kind of notion of what this drive is. So I'm going to go into a root shell so that I have access to that block device. And I'm going to go dd infile if equals slash dev slash zero outfile equals slash dev slash sdc. In your case, it might be something else. So from here on, I'm just going to say sdx because it's highly unlikely that you're going to have an sdx on your system. And so that way you won't just sort of forget and hear me say something and then keep typing. So of equals dev sdx. And then we'll just do a count of, that's count equals, let's just do 496, because that typically seems to be the important bit at the front of the drive is usually in about the first 4096 bytes. So I hit return, and it very quickly returns the confirmation that DD usually gives you, you know, tells you how many records in, how many records out. So that happened very fast because we only wrote like 4,096 bytes at the very front of this drive. So now if I detach this drive from my computer and then plug it right back in, there's probably something with UDEV I could have done or UDisk or something. But anyway, I just unplugged it and plugged it back in. Now, if there had been a partition there, there's not because I've been screwing around with it. But if there had been, it would no longer have a partition, you know, no longer have partition information. It wouldn't really know what kind of drive this was. It has lost all kinds of information from the start of the drive, which I warned you that would happen. So now that we have sort of a blank-ish slate, and we didn't have to do that first. You can ruin a drive without doing that, but I just wanted to demonstrate that you can sort of, you can think a drive is dead just by killing the information that it knows about itself, which is kept at the front of the drive. So it's not always necessarily the worst thing in the world, and that's why you can sometimes rescue partitions. So what we'll do now is we will do an echo and then the string hello, and we will redirect that to slash dev slash, well, actually, you know what I'm going to do is just make sure that I'm still, because I've unplugged and plugged back in. So ls block is still sdx. Okay, perfect. So I'm going to echo hello, just the string hello, and I'm going to redirect that echo to slash dev slash sdc. And again, it just kind of returns nothing because it just works. So now what we've done is we've echoed the string hello, which is, what, 5 bytes, onto the thumb drive that we're using. So essentially we've written a file to this thumb drive, but we have not, for instance, copied the file there. We have not moved the file there. We've not touched the file. We've not really created a file. We have just echoed raw data to the drive. And you can actually even see this with, for instance, let's do a couple ways you could do it, but let's do head-c for, I think, count. And we'll do, what did we say? It was five bytes. So we'll do count brace, that's the curly bracket, 0.4, I think, is what it should be, I think, if I'm doing that right. And then we'll do slash dev slash sdc, or sdx, rather. No, I was wrong. It was 0.5. And if you do that, then you get the string hello returned into your terminal, and it's way over on the left, so it'll appear before your prompt. It's echoed exactly correctly, and no breaks, no line breaks. So we've just pulled the data that we wrote to the file off of the block device, the data that we wrote to the drive off of the blocked device back into our terminal. So in theory, you could do that with anything. You know, you could like cat user shared docs GCC copying. It's not there, but yeah, wherever the you could send a whole file to the thumb drive without ever actually making a file. You're just writing the bytes to the drive, and then if you do a cat on that drive from a certain byte to a certain byte, then you will get your file, your data back. So I think, and I'm not sure because I haven't done a whole lot of research on this, and I've never done it myself, but I think that's how tape drives were for a while, or maybe even just hard drives in general were for a while, way, way back. You would tar everything up into a tape archive, tar file, and then you would dump it onto this thing. And you kind of had to know, or something on your system had to know, okay, so that archive is stored from, let's say, 0 to 255 bytes. It's not a very big archive. And we've got another archive, the rest of the backup, or the next day's backup is 256 to 512. And then when you pull them off, you would tell it, okay, go to sector such and such until such and such, and pipe that whole archive back to me, and then I will unarchive it, and there will be my files in kind of a minified file system within that archive. I could be a little bit hazy on the details, and I'm sure some HPR listener probably knows a lot more about this than I do, and they should probably record it and submit that as an HPR episode, because that'd be really cool to hear. But anyway, so you could do that in theory. If you wanted to be very kind of obscure about how you store your data, you could send, your shopping list to a thumb drive without any files, and just cat the data to the thumb drive. And you would know in your head, okay, that's from 0 to 25 bytes. 0 to 25 is my shopping list. It's a short shopping list. It's in code. And then from byte 26 to 42, I've got my agenda for the day, my to-do list. And then and that would work. And anytime you want to see your agenda, you would just cat 26 to 42, and you would get that back into your terminal, and you would be able to check things off your list. Ah, but now if you started checking things off your list, your data is getting bigger, right? So let's say you'd looked at your shopping list and you got some stuff, so you wanted to mark that off, but you wanted to add some more stuff on. So you're changing it, and now instead of your data being from 0 to whatever I said, 25, it's now maybe 0 to 22. So you got like these sort of three random bytes before the next thing begins. Well, that's okay. But we want to add something even longer to the end of it. We don't have that much space. Okay, well, what we'll do is we'll append the rest of our shopping list at the end of our agenda from 43 to 40, to 62. And we'll just jot down on our little notebook that we keep as our journal, that the shopping list starts at 0, goes to 23, then there's 3 dead blocks, and then skip to 43 and go into 62. Those two things equal my complete shopping list. So obviously, if you were to do this, if you were to fly without a file system, things would get very complex pretty quickly. I mean, especially if you're ever changing any file. And that's the advantage of a file system, because a file system can keep track of that stuff for you. It doesn't have to necessarily write everything contiguously. It might. It just depends on the file system design. But it can figure out where files need to begin, where they've ended, where the changes are stored, and it can kind of track all that stuff for you. Or maybe it is part of its design to not split data up and make sure that it can, move data around to make room for other stuff. Whatever, there's lots of different file system types, and I'm sure we've all heard all of the different pros and cons. This is journaling, this is non-journaling, this needs to be defragged, this does not need to be defragged, all that sort of thing. And so that's a file system. That's how you can survive without a file system, Although that's not advisable, but that's how you can kind of think of a file system. It's the thing that you don't have to do when you're writing data repeatedly back to a storage device. So I was thinking lately about different file systems, and I've been playing around with a couple of different ones. I mean, JFS I've been using on my main computers for ages. That's my sort of go-to file system. I'm pretty happy with it. And I'm not seeking a replacement for that. But in terms of thumb drives, I've never really been super happy with any of the file systems necessarily that I've used on thumb drives. And I tend to use UDF, which is the Universal Disk Format, which was originally developed actually for optical media. Like it was going to replace, or it is a replacement for ISO 9660. So instead of ISO 9660 on DVDs, you may have UDF on Blu-ray, for instance. So UDF is nice because, yeah, to any other system, it's essentially, it thinks it's just kind of a Blu-ray, sort of, not exactly, but as long as your system can read Blu-ray, for instance, then, and most of them can these days, you know, they usually have that driver, then it can probably read a UDF device. And that's not always true. I mean, it depends on the computer, the OS, and how the OEM, or not the OEM, but the programmers have sort of made the OS aware of what driver to invoke at certain times. But generally speaking, UDF has been a really good cross-platform and permissionless file system. The main problem with it is that it doesn't have an FSCK function at all. I tracked one down to, I think, Solaris, and I think it would either not build or it wasn't complete. And I heard rumors that NetBSD had one, but I'm not sure. And either way, you have to work that hard for an FSCK. You kind of lose a little bit of confidence in that format. So I was kind of looking at other options. And then something happened with UFS recently that's UFS, the BSD file system, Unix file system, whatever, where I hadn't had journaling turned on. And so, I don't know, I got to thinking about looking at other file systems, not to replace anything, just to branch out. That's what I'm trying to say. So one of the file systems that kind of came up a couple of times was NilFS. And NilFS, I believe I first heard from my friend DeepGeek, who you'll probably know from previous Hacker Public Radio episodes. He did Talk Geek to Me, and I'm pretty sure he did a really great episode on Beowulf clusters, if I recall correctly. So yeah, you might know him. You might not. Doesn't matter. He told me about NilFS a long time ago, and it kind of made me, when I was looking around and it kind of kept coming up, I thought, okay, I'm going to look into this thing. Because specifically, I thought NilFS meant, like, nil in American English is a synonym for none. You know, like nil is, it means zero. It means none. I don't know if it's slang or what, but it means zero. So I thought NilFS meant no file system. And I thought, okay, I'm going to look into this because that sounds crazy enough to sort of be something that might be fun to play with. It turns out NilFS has nothing to do with zero values. It has zero to do with zero values. It stands for New Implementation of Log Structured File System, NilFS. So it was developed apparently by Nippon Telegraph and Telephone, so sort of, I guess, the Japanese version of AT&T maybe. And it is designed to be a snapshotting file system. And I've never really played around with that. But a lot of people obviously talk about snapshotting nowadays because of ZFS and ButterFS and I think CephFS. Lots of modern file systems seem to kind of be really excited about this concept of built-in snapshots. So I figured I'd give NilFS a go and try to learn how to use it. And it's not that hard to play around with, really. It's not bad at all. So if you install NilFS, you'll probably find that you already have it on most Linux systems, because unless someone trimmed down your kernel quite a bit, it should be included, from what I understand, since like 2005. I don't know what its support is like in other operating systems. I've not looked into that at all. But you should find that you have it. And if you do an mkfs.nilfs2, nilfs2, you should find that it exists on your system. And of course, a dash h will give you the help. And it's a pretty simple kind of typical makefs interface. So it's mkfs.nilfs2 dash capital L for the label. So I'll just call this nil nil. And let's see, I think that's about all I need, really. Slash dev slash sdx. Now you're noticing possibly that I'm not bothering to put a partition on this device. And I don't know if NilFS wants a partition or if it needs a partition. Well, I know it doesn't need a partition because it works. But I don't know if it wants a partition. I don't know what the advice of the NilFS people is about partitioning, but I'm not going to bother right now. And it never has complained. It just creates the file system. So at this point, if I eject NilFS, the device rather, and then pop it back in. And by eject, I meant unattach or detach. So there I've got nil nil. And if I click on it, it should open up in the file manager, and there it goes. So it's an empty, a very empty drive. It doesn't even have that lost and found folder that the ext file systems drop in. So it's almost unsettling how empty this thing is. Okay, so the first thing that we'll do then is well, we'll just cd into slash run slash media slash clat2 slash nil nil and do an ls, and sure enough, there's nothing there. So now if I do an lscp, so all of the not all of the, but many of the nilfs commands are appended with cp, meaning not copy but checkpoints. So an lscp is to list all the checkpoints on this drive. Now right now there's only one checkpoint, and that is just a couple of seconds ago, because I created a checkpoint. And this is a little bit over verbose, honestly, or at least to start with. I'm sure this is all very useful information, but to start with, it's a little bit over verbose. So the only thing you really need to look at is the number, the checkpoint number, which is on the extreme left. So right now I'm looking at one. It's labeled one. It tells you the date and the time that that checkpoint was cataloged, and then it tells you what it is. So the mode is, in this case, a checkpoint. And as far as I know, it can be two modes. It can be a checkpoint, CP, or it can be a snapshot, SS. And that's the part that you need to sort of know, really. So now if we touch a file, if we touch test1.txt, and we can even echo hello CP1 into our test file, just for kicks. So now if I do an lscp again, because now we've created a file, we've put stuff in the file, it's made a new checkpoint. And that checkpoint is numbered 2, and it is just seconds ago, and it is still a checkpoint, a CP. So that's checkpoints for you in NilFS. What you can do is, if you want to, you can do an lscp-s to list the snapshots. That's actually a filter on the checkpoints. So I get nothing right now. I get just the headers, I get no content of that list. And that's to be expected because we don't actually have any snapshots yet. but we can create snapshots. And the way that you create a snapshot is that you convert a checkpoint into a snapshot. So I know that we're at a pretty good state in our file system right now. We've got this test file. It says some stuff in it. Let's go ahead and do a make checkpoint, mkcp. But we're not going to make a checkpoint. I mean, you could. That would be kind of like a git commit or a git. Yeah, I guess it would be like a git commit. If we're, yeah, let's call it a git commit. Make checkpoint and then dash s or dash dash snapshot if you prefer the long form. And hit return, and you've just made a snapshot of your file system. You can check that with lscp. And sure enough, I've got one is at 1554 at checkpoint. I got two at 1556 checkpoint, and I got number three at 1556 and 53 seconds snapshot. So there you go. That's because I've converted the checkpoint to a snapshot. It's not because I did it at the same time. It's on my system. It shows it being about, I don't know, eight seconds apart. I'm not really sure what the 8 seconds are for. But yeah, it's creating the snapshot from that previous checkpoint. So three is a snapshot. So again, lscp-s just to show the snapshots. Now I've got, yeah, snapshot number three, or item number three, which is the only thing on this line, is a snapshot. And it was taken today at 1556.53. So the lscp-s is kind of a nice way to just kind of filter out the needless information of all those checkpoints. Like, it's nice to know the checkpoints, but at the same time, it kind of doesn't matter that much, because the only thing that's going to really stick are the snapshots. So let's just do an rm test1.txt. It says remove regular file. Yes, remove that file. Okay, so now I have got an empty drive. Well, not technically. There's a hidden directory there about nilfs, but anyway, now I've got an empty drive. The file that I created is gone. It's totally gone. Okay, perfect. So I'll get out of this this place, and I will now eject my drive. Now this is where a little bit of intervention is going to be required, because if I just pop this drive back in, then my file manager is going to want to access it in its current state, in its latest checkpoint. So if I do that, and I just did, it's an empty window again. There's nothing in this on this drive. It's gone. I removed the file. I mean, obviously it's gone, right? Okay. So I will eject this again. And it's safe to remove it, it says. So I'm going to remove it, and then I'm going to reattach it, but I'm not going to mount the hard drive via my desktop anymore. I'm going to instead do a make directory in my temp directory, and I'll call it nil, and now I will do a mount, a manual mount. So I'm going to do mount dash dash type nilfs2 dash dash read dash only dash dash options, and the option that I want to invoke, which is specific to nilfs2, this wouldn't make any sense to anything else, is cp equals 3. Why 3? Well, because that's where my snapshot is. And then we'll do /dev/sdx, and we'll mount that to /temp/nil. So now if I launch a browser, a window browser, file manager is what they're called, to /temp/nil, there's my test1.txt. And of course it does contain hello cp1. So there you go. A file that I've removed still exists because I took a snapshot of it. And that's pretty impressive. It's one of those features that you, once you see it in action, like once you really experience it, I mean, you've heard about it now, right? You've listened in on me as I've tried it, and it works. But I urge you to go home and try this yourself, because it is immensely satisfying. I mean, you might be one of those people who have already switched over to ButterFS or ZFS or something, but for me, seeing that in action, it was pretty darned impressive. The workflow is a little bit funny. I'm not sure 100%, how you would decide when to take a snapshot. Maybe you would take a snapshot every couple of hours. Maybe you'd take a snapshot at the end of every day. I don't know. I guess it kind of depends. I think that my only personal equivalent to this experience has been Git, and Git is obviously very project oriented, or at least I shouldn't say obviously because it's not obvious. The way that I use Git is very project oriented, and it tends to be project oriented. Now, I know that some people out there use Git to manage their home directory. I've heard of people doing that. And yeah, that would never work for me because of all the huge binary blobs that I would have lying around. And like, why would you commit that to Git? But I mean, if it's on the drive anyway and you're taking a snapshot, it kind of makes a lot of sense. I guess the question is, like, again, just how do you know when to take that snapshot? Do you take it when you just feel really good about something, or yeah, I don't know. I feel like with Git, I can make commits and pushes. Like a snapshot, I'm thinking of as a push. Like if I snapshot something, then that's been committed to, or that's been pushed to the remote. That is now something that is set in stone. It exists. Whereas if I'm, the checkpoints, I guess, would be like the commits. And you don't make the checkpoints. You just, the checkpoints happen as you work. So that's really easy for me. I get that. It's the question of when do I say, okay, this is a point in time that I might want to come back to this particular file. And in that, then when do I know, how do I find that file again? There's no, I don't know yet at least how to annotate anything. So it's not like I could make a bunch of changes to something and then do a commit log where I'm saying like, okay, I've implemented this feature. Oh, I broke this feature, but I fixed another one. In the next, in the next commit, I'll fix this feature again. I don't, with this snapshot feature, I don't really know how to make that happen. That said, it sure is refreshing to be able to just delete stuff and then go back to a snapshot and there it is again, or screw it up and then go back to a snapshot. So it's definitely neat. It's definitely a satisfying experience. And if you have not tried it, you should try it. You've just heard me do it. It is super easy to attempt. It is easy to implement. It's pretty much built in. There's no extra install. Yeah, it's worth a shot. Now, I did all of that as root, and if you don't do it as root, then you will have to manage permissions and make sure that you're doing things, as you would on an external drive on Linux. NilFS is conscious and aware of file permissions, so if you don't do something with the file permissions on that drive, you will run into that sort of weird, like, I have a thumb drive and I'm plugging it into my computer at school or at work where my username is one thing, and then I come home and I'm plugging into my home computer where my username is some other thing, or I'm handing it to my friend whose username is another. You have that whole thing happening because it's a, yeah, it's a permission aware file system, which great for some things, not so great for other things. So I'm not really sure how much I'll actually use NilFS on thumb drives necessarily. But it is definitely something I'm going to start looking into for kicks because it is kind of fun to try. And it has been around since apparently like 2005. So it's been around. It's got a history. I don't know if that means it's proven exactly or not, but I don't know. It seems to be a pretty cool little file system to mess around with. So NilFS 2, you should try it. It's fun. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hecka Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.